There is a price. During these first years, most of the sugar that the little plant makes in its leaves will go directly into the fungus, suckling at its roots. The webbing that surrounds these struggling roots does not penetrate them, however, and the plant and fungus remain physically separate, but enjoined by their life's work. They anchor each other. They will work together until the tree is tall enough to fight for light at the top of the canopy. Why are they together, the tree and the fungus? We don't know. The fungus could certainly live very well alone almost anywhere, but it chooses to entwine itself with the tree over an easier and more independent life. It has adapted to seek the rush of pure sweetness that comes directly from a plant root. Such a strange and concentrated compound, unlike anything to be found elsewhere in the forest. And perhaps the fungus can somehow sense that when it is part of a symbiosis, it is also not alone. Chapter 4. Soil is a funny thing, in that it isn't really anything in and of itself, but is instead the product of two different worlds coming together. Soil is the naturally produced graffiti that results from tensions between the biological and geological realms. Back in California, Bill and I decided that we would teach our soil class differently from the way it was taught to us. Instead of just filling out forms and cataloging data, we would teach where soil comes from and how it forms. We'd make students really look at it, touch it, draw it, and come up with their own improvised labels for what they saw. We developed a teaching protocol that goes like this. We simply pick a place and we dig. We dig the earth open until we can see it whole and naked from top to bottom. We expose what was unexposed and force its secrets out into the open. All around us, we can point concretely to what's alive. A green leaf, a moving worm, a sucking root. At depth lies cold, hard rock, old as the hills to our right and left, and equally devoid of breath and movement. Not alive. Everything that is physically located between the two extremes, alive and not alive, we call soil. At the top of the soil, the influence of the living is most obvious. Dark brown rubbed from the residue of dead plants, wilted and rotten, mixed into a slime that seeps and stains everything around it. The bottom of the soil is dominated by the rock's legacy. The waters of the ages have dissolved the rock little by little, churned it into a paste, and dried, wetted, dried it over endless cycles, to yield a slag that is distinct from the undamaged rocks that lie below. In the middle, these two substances interact, sometimes blooming into the garish streaks of color that so struck us when we drove through southern Georgia. Bill was born to tirelessly evangelize soil, using his God-given talent for marking the subtleties of chemistry, the shading of colors, and the twitches in texture that only he can see from within a hole. He can compare the dozens of soils he carries in his memory with the one before him in bafflingly excruciating detail. All reserve is shed when he talks about soil, and I have watched him deliver many dramatic monologues in Irish pubs, perfectly sober, describing how the discovery of new colors and new combinations underground is what he loves most about his work. In the summer of 1997, we took a group of five students into the field to teach them how to characterize and map soil. The trip was a first-time experience for four of them, and a repeat trip for the undergraduate who volunteered many hours in my lab each week. Bill had warmed up to this guy, and I had also, and so we invited him to come along on each of our research and teaching excursions. The best way to prevent people from complaining about food while camping is to force each one of them to take responsibility for one night of cooking. and our undergraduate mascot had eagerly volunteered. Desperate to impress us, he had brought cans, boxes, spices, and a bag of potatoes that he peeled and then boiled until soft. But he was only able to start cooking at about 11 p.m., after we finally arrived at the campground. Boiling water on a campfire is tortuously slow, and so I was dismayed when, after removing the cooked potatoes, he set another huge pot of cold water over the heat to boil. Instead of just doling out the potatoes with a fork, which would have been haute cuisine by our standards, he instead began to mash them, adding the fine milled flour that had appeared from his backpack. I noted with alarm that the cooking process was starting all over again, and I asked him what he was doing. "I'm making Hungarian potato dumplings," he explained. "My grandmother used to make them. Trust me, you'll love them." We ate at about 3 in the morning. "Hey, you should start going by dumpling," I exclaimed as we finally sat down to eat. And the student's face lit up. He was delighted with the professional intimacy that a private joke implied. "I will not refer to him as dumpling," Bill said with a masculine scowl as he bent over his soup. He was tired and hungry and not in the mood. The warm night air was perfectly still, and we could hear a chorus of frogs that were croaking somewhere in the darkness. We all ate in silence, stuffing ourselves with the delicious dumplings that had been prepared in ridiculous abundance. While we were cleaning up, Bill was the first to comment. "Good dinner, dumpling," he said solemnly while gathering up the empty bowls. Whatever the student's real name was, I have since forgotten it, for it was never used by any of us again. I have also never eaten anything that tasted as good as those dumplings in all my years since then. We were digging in Atkinson County, which, although it does not seem notable for anything, we referred to as Nirvana because of its exquisite soils, unequaled within the 49 other states and 5 continents we have traveled. We found it the same way that we found so many of our teaching sites, from the car window. If you drive across the state of Georgia from the Piedmont Plain near Atlanta, southeast, toward the Atlantic Ocean, you will find yourself driving along a river of red dust that was rubbed from the residue of what might have been mountains in some ancient geological dream. While driving on Highway 82 toward the Okefenokee Swamp earlier that year, we had seen what appeared to be buckets of rich apricot paint thrown across a ditch of creamy sand. In those days, Bill required a cigarette frequently, and so we were in the habit of stopping often to inspect the landscape. When we had pulled over near Willacoochee, the paint turned out to be the rusted iron band within a rare oxisol soil type, and we immediately decided to include the stop in our soils course. When we arrive at a soil site with students, we first unload the shovels, the picks, a tarp, the sieves, the chemicals, and a big blackboard with colored chalk. We dig a hole down deeper and deeper until we hit hard rock, careful to stand only on one side so that everyone is looking at the same thing. Once we have dug deeply enough, we dig away from the profile, opening a pit that is large enough for 3 people to stand in, and from which we can make an evaluation as to the lateral continuity of the soil's properties. This digging can take hours, and if the clay is thick or the soil is waterlogged, it is physically exhausting. Bill and I dig together as sort of a waltz, with one of us throwing and the other catching. One person chips the ground with a pick, while another positions one shovel below to catch the debris. When that shovel is full, it is swapped for another, and the original one is emptied to the side. Unlike holes that are dug for construction purposes, the fill must be carefully piled to the side in order to keep the bottom clear and provide a view all the way up to the top of the hole. Even as we avoid compressing the soil profile, there are always stray students who we notice standing on the top and looking down on us, and we shoo them away like the chipmunks at the campground. When we ask for digging volunteers, we are occasionally taken up on the offer by what inevitably turns out to be the farm kid of the group. But most students don't really want to dig. In the old days, they used to stand idly by, watching us dig for hours, which peeved us. Now they turn sideways, surreptitiously searching for cell phone signals. Once we can see new earth from top to bottom, we take pins, old railroad spikes that we painted bright orange, and insert them at the boundaries between what we think we see as layers. Bill and I argue about the direction of the sun and over whether each detail is real or just a shadow, and we work to convince each other of our opinions like lawyers in a contentious trial, with no judge and a bored jury. Sometimes soil boundaries are distinct, as within a chocolate vanilla layer cake, and sometimes they are as gradual as the edge to middle change of red within one square of a Mondrian painting. Although they form a foundation for all of the data that will follow, the number and placing of these soil horizons are the most subjective part of the exercise, and each scientist displays a slightly different style. Some, like me, feel we're creating modern art out of the landscape, preferring the result to be huge and whole, with as few rules guiding the eye as possible. We are known as lumpers because we tend to lump the details together as we work. Others, including Bill, are more like the impressionists, convinced that each brushstroke must be executed with individuality in order to achieve a coherent whole. They are known as splitters because they split the subtle details into separate categories as they work. The only way to do good soil science is to put a splitter and a lumper together in the soil pit and let them fight it out until they achieve something that they both know must be correct because neither of them feels satisfied. Left to her own devices, the lumper will dig for 3 hours, mark the horizons in 10 minutes, and then go on her merry way. Left to his own devices, the splitter will dig a hole and crawl inside, never to be seen again. Thus, splitters and lumpers are both productive only when forced into bickering collaboration. And though together they produce great maps, they rarely return from field trips still on speaking terms. Once the soil horizon demarcations have been successfully negotiated, a sample is removed from each layer, relocated to the tarp, and subjected to a battery of chemical tests to determine acidity, salt content, nutrient levels, and a growing list of field-ready chemical attributes. At the end of the day, all the information is transferred to the blackboard, graphed and drawn, and a long discussion ensues about what the visual properties and the chemical properties, taken together, imply about the fertility of the soil. Fertility being one of the most grandiose and imprecise terms that science has ever produced. The ideal educational field trip lasts about a week, with one new soil written up each day, and about 100 miles of driving afterward toward another site. 5 days and 500 miles provide enough time and space to give students an idea as to how much soils vary across the landscape, and also to expose them to the thoughtful, ramblin' mindset necessary for soils work. By the end of the trip, they are either in love with the work or utterly turned off, and therefore have probably decided upon a major as well. By dragging students through dirt for 5 days, I can do something far more important and significant than I can do for them during an entire semester behind a desk. And so Bill and I have clocked tens of thousands of miles on these trips. Bill is the most patient, caring, and respectful teacher that I have ever seen in action. He will sit with a student for as long as it takes, sometimes hours if needed, in order to help him or her learn just one task. He does the very hardest work of teaching, not just relating facts from a book, but standing over a machine and showing how to work it with your hands, how it might break, and how to fix it when it does. Students call him at 2 a.m. when they can't work something, and he wearily comes down to the lab and helps them, if he's not already there, of course. He continues tirelessly to coax the slower students toward success, long after I've become frustrated and written them off as not trying hard enough. Of course, 20-somethings being what they are, most students take Bill completely for granted, save a very few who understand that by the end, their thesis is often as much his as it is theirs. Nevertheless, the most efficient way to get yourself fired from my lab and out on the street is to openly disrespect Bill. You can call me any name you like, but he is your superior, and you will remember it and act accordingly. For his part, Bill complains about each student with uniformly wicked contempt, and then spends yet another day rescuing them from themselves. At about 5 o'clock on that day in southern Georgia, technically the same day we ate the dumplings, we filled in the hole that we had dug and packed up our gear. We stopped in Waycross to replenish the gas tank and our candy supply. While we were debating the advantages of the Hershey bar versus Starbursts, Dumpling approached us and said, "I don't want to go see Stucky. I'm tired of him, and I think he freaks Reba out." During each field trip, we set aside time for one enrichment activity, and Dumpling preferred not to revisit the one we'd made a habit of enjoying during our previous trips to that site. Stucky is a fossilized dog that is on display within a museum called Southern Forest World, and is even more unique than it sounds. According to the paleontological expertise that was brought to bear on the specimen, it is the remains of a dog that ran up a hollow tree, probably chasing an animal, and got stuck and died. The tree petrified while the dog mummified within it, thus preserving for eternity the real-life tableau of a Tom and Jerry cartoon. Stucky fascinated me, and I love to imagine him as Creon breaking into Antigone's tomb, his face contorted into a grimace of need and regret. When I recalled, however, that Reba always refused to go anywhere near the macabre thing, I realized that from her perspective, Stucky was a sort of canine poor Yorick whose smell probably inspired unpleasant ruminations about a dog's place in the universe. I made a mental note to apologize later while I watched her mill about near the dumpster in one of my bright orange Orioles t-shirts, worn to increase visibility when ambling near the highway. "I don't know," I thought, hesitating, and then said, "Bill really looks forward to Stucky." Bill was ambivalent. "My enjoyment of Stucky is compromised by your babbling about Greek crap," he noted. "Which starts earlier and earlier during each trip, by the way." "Okay, any ideas about where we should go instead?" I asked Dumpling, and Bill shot me a furious look, enraged that I would do something so foolhardy as let a student chart our course. Tradition dictated that we had to go do some goofy tourist thing before returning home. "How about that place we always see on the billboard? Monkey Jungle. It looks cool," Dumpling offered. I threw my backpack in the van and whistled for Reba. "Monkey Jungle it is. All aboard," I called out to the group. "Why not? It's only 8 hours away," growled Bill while staring daggers at me. I smiled sweetly in return, and once he realized that I was serious, we both got in the car. Bill does all the driving when we go on the road. He is an excellent driver who merges onto the highway, gets behind the biggest truck he can find, and then follows it at a safe distance for as many miles as possible. I am never allowed to drive because I don't have the patience required by big landscapes. My mind wanders as I drive, and the asphalt road starts to seem more flexible than it really is. My job instead is to talk for hours and dream up scenarios outrageous enough to make Bill laugh, which becomes more challenging as the miles drag on. I used to think that Bill habitually drove 50 miles per hour because of the responsibility he felt toward our student cargo. But after learning the life history of every motorized vehicle he had ever owned, I later realized that he couldn't actually know that they were capable of mile-per-minute travel. Regardless, my attitude had become that I could go anywhere in the world, provided that I was willing to ride shotgun long enough. Once we had agreed to skip Stuckey, there was nothing for it but to get on the highway and drive south. 10 or so exits north of the Florida border, we saw a huge black billboard displaying only 2 words written in neon pink. Butt naked. It bothered me that I couldn't figure it out. What does that mean? I mused aloud in my ignorance. Is it a bar? Or a strip club? Or a video shop or something? I think it's pretty clear what it means, said Bill. It means that if you get off the highway, there's something butt naked at or near the exit. But I mean, is it a woman or a man or a mole rat or what? Is it even connected to something? I mused. Or does it imply that you have the opportunity to get yourself butt naked? It's probably some kind of Gomer code for something really sick, volunteered a student who was notorious for his derision of all things south of the Mason-Dixon line. Listen, explained Bill. If you're the kind of guy who's going to pull off of the highway after seeing a sign like that, you're probably also the kind of guy who doesn't care what's butt naked on the other end. As soon as you see the words butt and naked, you hit the brakes and just go with it. One of the more politically conscious graduate students tried to stir the pot by asking, "Why are you assuming that it would be a guy who is going to a place like that?" Bill shook his head and continued to stare at the road, unwilling to dignify his question with a response. Fortunately, it wasn't long before a better billboard caught our attention. "Explore Monkey Jungle," it commanded us, "where humans are caged and monkeys run wild." We all shrieked in jubilation. "We must be getting close," suggested one of the students hopefully. Bill shrugged. "Well, we are in Florida." We had just passed a sign marking the border and welcoming us to the Sunshine State. The attraction we were headed toward was located near Miami, still about 7 hours' drive south of where we were. Monkey Jungle didn't appear quite so inviting when we pulled into its parking lot that night at 1 a.m., given that its lights were off and a heavy link chain bound the handles of the front door. Bill jumped out of the van as soon as he parked, to inspect the sign on the door, and also to inhale dried Nicotiana tobacum leaves, as he had taken to describing it. The students spilled out of the van like an undone bag of marbles, a few rolling off and becoming unreachable as the majority congregated in place. Bill returned to the group and suggested that we set up our tents on the grassy patch in front of the entrance and sleep until the place opened at 9:30 a.m. He took a drag of his cigarette. "I figure that somewhere during the course of opening shop they'll bother to wake us up," he said. Dumpling chimed in. "That way we'll be first in line." "I don't know if that's such a good idea," I said. "Don't monkeys crow at dawn like roosters or something?" "You tell us," said Bill as he rubbed out his cigarette. "You're the one who's been sleeping with a monkey." He was referring to my latest on-again, off-again boyfriend, who was indeed no Rhodes Scholar. I stood there with a smirk on my face while Bill unloaded the coolers and then went to work setting up my tent before unpacking his own, a signal that he had meant no offense. In order to signal back that no offense had been taken, I started digging through the cooler and tried to come up with an idea for dinner. "Well, it looks like dinner on a stick," I announced, having found extremely little with which to cook us anything. That's awesome, Bill said supportively, having finished with the tents in record time. It's my favorite, he added without sarcasm, and then pulled out an armload of wood and got to work building a fire. It was our custom to visit the campus wood shop before each field trip, and to load up the van with the scrap pieces of wood that had been otherwise destined for the pulp bin. Afterward, we'd do the same with cardboard taken from the campus recycling center. On the way out of town, we'd buy one Duraflame log for each day of the trip, and a bunch of random food, and consider ourselves prepared for camping. We'd use these materials each night to build what I called an Andy Warhol fire, within which we'd use the everlit log to ignite a continuous stream of recyclable materials. And the emergent blaze always had a satisfyingly garish result. You could cook over such a fire, provided that your sleeves weren't flammable, and that you didn't mind if the middle of whatever you were eating was cold and raw. Dinner on a stick meant that each person found a stick and put whatever they wanted on it, and then stuck it in the fire and ate it, and that was dinner. The only rule was that if you stumbled upon something really good, you afterward had to make enough for the whole group, or at least try to make it again and divvy up the result. Dumpling was on a roll during that trip, and actually managed to poach pears using a Coke can that had been torn in half and ingeniously skewered on a stick. We all agreed that his Hershey's chocolate-drizzled creation was the absolute pinnacle of camping cuisine, except for his dumplings, of course, and everyone went off to bed happily. Soon after falling asleep, I was unceremoniously awoken by someone with a deep voice and an extremely bright flashlight. I stuck my head outside the tent. "Can I help you, officer?" I asked. Puzzled to find a reasonably clean and articulate woman instead of a desperately unwashed and incoherent man, the patrolman inquired what we were doing there. I explained our field trip in detail, accentuating my pedagogical duty to fulfill one talented student's specific desire to visit the renowned Monkey Jungle in person before his brief youth had faded. As so often occurs when I find myself in such situations, the officer's authoritarian skepticism melted into hospitality while I waxed rhapsodic over the rare and peerless Floridian soils. Within a couple of minutes, he was offering everything from professional surveillance while we slept to a police escort when we chose to depart for Atlanta. I declined his assistance gratefully, assuring him that I would indeed call 911 on the payphone down the road if I needed anything, and we parted on excellent terms. After he drove off, Bill stuck his head out of his tent. "That was masterful," he said. "You amaze me." I looked up at the stars and took a deep breath of the humid air. "Damn," I said contentedly. "I love the South." The incomparable welcome peculiar to the southern states continued the next morning when the admissions desk of Monkey Jungle waved our whole group through upon receipt of the insufficient sum of $57, which represented every last bit of paper money that Bill and I could produce from our pockets. After we walked out of the foyer and through the doors that led to the jungle, we were immediately overwhelmed by the screaming. It emanated from a diverse population of monkey inmates as a large number of them turned their attention toward us. "Good God, it's just like walking into the lab," said Bill, his face twisted into what I recognized as his pre-migraine countenance. The room we were in was actually a very large courtyard within the building complex, which had all the architectural panache of your average DMV. In a great arc over the top of the courtyard, long stretches of chicken wire were seamed together and appeared to have been repeatedly reinforced in certain places. Homo sapiens visiting the courtyard could walk through the space within a hallway bounded by steel mesh, hence the billboard slogan. Monkey Jungle was indeed a doppelganger for my lab, and the more I thought about it, the clearer the comparison became. Perhaps the ambiance had been amplified by a couple of orders of magnitude, but each of our research activities was represented by its simian equivalent within the enclosure. 3 Java macaques that had been straining their brains over some problem that they could neither solve nor abandon propelled themselves toward us, supposing that we somehow represented an answer. A white-handed gibbon was draped limply across our walkway, either asleep or dead or someplace in between. 2 small squirrel monkeys seemed to be trapped in their own private Samuel Beckett play, caught in a web made of equal parts dependence and loathing. In ironic proximity, 2 other squirrel monkeys were getting along very, very well by the looks of it. A single howler monkey sat high on a branch in the back, wailing out the entire Book of Job in his native tongue, while periodically raising his arms in an age-old supplication for an explanation as to why the righteous must suffer. A red-handed tamarin crouched in paranoia, rubbing its hands together and scheming towards some sinister end. 2 beautiful Diana monkeys meticulously groomed each other while psychologically adrift upon an ocean of boredom. An exhausted cadre of capuchins paced the perimeter, compulsively checking and rechecking the empty feeding troughs for the raisin that they were certain was right there a minute ago. "Every monkey is some monkey's monkey," I said out loud. I then happened to notice Bill across the courtyard standing face to face with a spider monkey, separated only by a rusty screen. Both of them sported the same hairdo, a 3-inch-long, dark brown, shiny mop that stuck up in all directions, having been groomed with little more than a few vigorous scratches during the last 2 weeks. This same shag covered both of their faces, and their lithe limbs hung with an athletic readiness that was only weakly camouflaged by their affected slouches. The spider monkey's dark, limpid eyes were very wide open, and his facial expression suggested that he was in a permanent state of shock. The fascination between Bill and the monkey was so complete that it was as if the rest of the world didn't exist. As I watched, I felt the cramps in my stomach that customarily foreshadowed the laughing that continues long past the point of being pleasant or comfortable. Bill finally stated, without redirecting his stare, "It's like looking in a fucking mirror." I doubled over into a series of helpless guffaws that eventually progressed into sort of a prayer for relief. When Bill was good and ready, he and the spider monkey parted ways, and we progressed into the final chamber of the jungle, where a huge gorilla named King sat in a cement hole, not dissimilar to those used to impose solitary confinement upon the prisoners of my own species. King's 300-pound frame slumped against the tile as he used one foot to listlessly rub a crayon back and forth across a piece of paper. The walls of the room from which we viewed him were plastered with his finished paintings, each of which had been executed by King using a similar technique. Taken together, they expressed an impressively consistent artistic view. "At least he's publishing," I observed. We read a plaque that described the heavy crosses that lowland gorillas must bear within their native Africa, which ranged from poaching to disease. Yet it was difficult to imagine any corner of the Congo more dismal than the abject constriction within which King had been impounded in Florida. We read a second, rather apologetic plaque describing how King's overflow art could be purchased in the gift shop, and that some of the proceeds were earmarked toward the remodeling and expansion of his enclosure. If King had had a handgun, I was pretty sure that he would have blown his own head off. But seeing that he was armed only with a crayon, he appeared to be making the best of his situation. While I waited for the students to run out of raisins with which to feed the monkeys, I inwardly vowed to stop complaining about my relatively bountiful lot in life. "Well, I hope that poor son of a bitch gets tenure," sighed Bill from his side of the room. "Oh, I wouldn't worry about it," I assured him. "It looks like his institution views him as permanent, and he is bringing in money." Bill looked at me. I wasn't talking about the gorilla. While trickling through the gift shop, we deposited our last coins in the plexiglass donation box, but we refrained from using our credit cards to buy one of King's paintings. "I may not know art, but I know what I like," explained Bill as he walked away from the display indifferently. In the parking lot, I instructed the students to use the bathroom now, as we had a long drive ahead of us, and in my head I fantasized about the day after my promotion, when I would commission a t-shirt for myself that read, "I am not your mom," and begin wearing it to work. Once we were all loaded into the van, and the doors were slammed shut, I took off my hiking boots and cracked open a Diet Coke for Bill. "We went to Monkey Jungle to learn about monkeys, and along the way we learned a little bit about ourselves," I quipped in my most saccharine teacher's voice. "I fucking met myself," mumbled Bill as he craned his neck to look backward while reversing the van out of the parking lot. Once we had merged onto I-95, I put my feet up on the dash and settled into my familiar role of leading the group in killing time. I was about to incite a semantic argument over whether Monkey Jungle was a jungle of monkeys or a jungle for monkeys, but decided against it after looking into the rearview mirror and observing that Dumpling was already sleeping like a baby. Chapter 5. The life of a deciduous tree is ruled by its annual budget. Every year, during the short months from March to July, it must grow an entire new canopy of leaves. If it fails to meet its quota this year, some competitor will grow into a corner of its previous space, and thus initiate the long, slow process by which the tree will eventually lose its foothold and die. If a tree expects to be alive 10 years hence, it has no alternative but to succeed this year and every year after. Let's consider a modest, unremarkable tree, the one living on your street, perhaps. A decorative maple tree, about the height of a streetlight. Not a majestic maple reaching its full height in the forest. A demure neighborhood tree that's only one quarter the height of its regal counterpart. When the sun is directly overhead, the little maple in our example casts a shadow about the size of a parking space. However, if we pluck off all the leaves and lay them flat, side by side, they would cover 3 parking spaces. By suspending each leaf separately, the tree has stacked its surface area into a sort of ladder for light to fall down. Looking up, you notice that the leaves at the top of any tree are smaller, on average, than the leaves at the bottom. This allows sunlight to be caught near the base whenever the wind blows and parts the upper branches. Look again, and you'll notice that leaves low in the canopy are of a darker green. They contain more of the pigment that helps each leaf absorb sunshine, allowing them to harvest the weaker rays that penetrate shade. When building foliage, a tree must budget for each leaf individually and allocate for each position relative to the other leaves. A good business plan will allow our tree to triumph as the largest and longest living being on your street. But it ain't easy, and it ain't cheap. The leaves on our little maple, all taken together, weigh 35 pounds. Every ounce therein must be pulled from the air or mined from the soil, and quickly, over the course of a few short months. From the atmosphere, a plant gains carbon dioxide, which it will make into sugar and pith. 35 pounds of maple leaves may not taste sweet to you and me, but they actually contain enough sucrose to make 3 pecan pies, which is the sweetest thing that I can think of right now. The pithy skeleton within the leaves contains enough cellulose to make almost 300 sheets of paper, which is about the number that I used to print out the manuscript for this book. Our tree's only source of energy is the sun. After light photons stimulate the pigments within the leaf, buzzing electrons line up into an unfathomably long chain and pass their excitement one to the other, moving biochemical energy across the cell to the exact location where it is needed. The plant pigment chlorophyll is a large molecule, and within the bowl of its spoon-shaped structure sits one single precious magnesium atom. The amount of magnesium needed for enough chlorophyll to fuel 35 pounds of leaves is equivalent to the amount of magnesium found in 14 one-a-day vitamins, and it must ultimately dissolve out of bedrock, which is a geologically slow process. Magnesium, phosphorus, iron, and the many other micronutrients that our tree needs can be gained only from the extremely dilute solution that flows in between the tiny mineral grains within the soil. In order to accumulate all of the soil nutrients that 35 pounds of leaves require, our tree must first absorb and then evaporate at least 8,000 gallons of water from the soil. That's enough to fill a tanker truck. That's enough to keep 25 people alive for a year. That's enough to make you worry about when it is next going to rain. The life of an academic scientist is ruled by her 3-year budget. Every 3rd year, she must solicit a new contract with the federal government. The grant money guaranteed within the contract provides the cash that pays the salaries of her employees. It also provides money to buy all of the materials and equipment that she will use within her experiments, and to pay for any travel necessary to complete the research objectives. Universities generally help a new science professor start up with a limited sum of discretionary funds, the academic version of a dowry, that support her while she attempts to secure a first contract. If she fails to land a deal within the first 2 or 3 years, she won't be able to do the work that she was trained to do, and thus won't produce the scholarship necessary to earn her tenure. If a new professor expects to have a job 10 years hence, she has no alternative but to succeed. This is all greatly complicated by the fact that there aren't nearly enough federal contracts to go around. The type of science that I do is sometimes known as curiosity-driven research. This means that my work will never result in a marketable product, a useful machine, a prescribable pill, a formidable weapon, or any direct material gain. Or if it does indirectly lead to one of those things, this would be figured out at some much later date by someone who is not me. As such, my research is a rather low priority for our national budget. There is just one significant source of monetary support for the kind of research that I do: the National Science Foundation, or NSF. The NSF is a U.S. government agency, and the money that it provides for scientific research comes from tax dollars. In 2013, the budget of the NSF was $7.3 billion. For comparison, the federal budget allocation for the Department of Agriculture, the people responsible for supervising food imports and exports, was about 3 times that amount. Each year, the U.S. government spends twice as much on its space program as it does on all of its other scientists put together. NASA's 2013 budget was more than $17 billion. And these discrepancies are nothing compared with the disparity between research and military spending. The Department of Homeland Security, created in response to the events of September 11, 2001, commands an annual budget that is fully 5 times larger than that of the entire NSF. While the Department of Defense's mere discretionary budget comes to more than 60 times that sum. One side effect of curiosity-driven research is the inspiring of young people. Researchers generally love their calling to excess and delight in nothing better than teaching others to love it also. As with all creatures driven by love, we can't help but breed. You may have heard that America doesn't have enough scientists and is in danger of falling behind, whatever that means, because of it. Tell this to an academic scientist and watch her laugh. For the last 30 years, the amount of the U.S. annual budget that goes to non-defense-related research has been frozen. From a purely budgetary perspective, we don't have too few scientists. We've got far too many, and we keep graduating more each year. America may say that it values science, but it sure as hell doesn't want to pay for it. Within environmental science in particular, we see the crippling effects that come from having been resource-hobbled for decades. Degrading farmland, species extinction, progressive deforestation. The list goes on and on. Nevertheless, $7.3 billion sounds like a lot of money. Remember that this figure must support all curiosity-driven science, not just biology, but also geology, chemistry, mathematics, physics, psychology, sociology, and the more esoteric forms of engineering and computer science as well. Because my work is about learning why plants have been so successful for so long, my research falls within the NSF's paleobiology program. In 2013, the amount of funding that paleobiology gave out for research was $6 million. This is the entire annual budget for all of the paleontology research that happens in America, and the dinosaur diggers predictably secure the lion's share. Nevertheless, $6 million still sounds like a lot of money. Perhaps we could agree that one paleobiologist from each state in the country should get a grant. If we divide $6 million by 50, we get $120,000 for each contract. And this is close to the reality. The NSF's paleobiology program gives out between 30 and 40 contracts each year, with an average value of $165,000 each. Thus, at any given time, there are about 100 funded paleobiologists in America. This is probably not enough to answer the public's many questions about evolution, even if we limit ourselves to the charismatically extinct, such as the dinosaur and the woolly mammoth. Note also that there are a lot more than 100 paleobiology professors in America, which means that most of them can't do the research they were trained to do. Nevertheless, $165,000 sounds like a lot of money, to me at least. But how far does it really go? Fortunately, the university pays my salary for most of the year. It is very uncommon for a professor to be paid when classes are not in session, that is, all summer long. But it is up to me to secure salary for Bill. If I choose to pay him $25,000 per year, he's got 20 years of experience after all, I need to request an additional $10,000 to pay for his benefits, bringing the total to $35,000 per year. On top of this, there's the interesting fact that the university effectively taxes the government for the research that its professors do. So on top of my request for $35,000, I must request another $15,000 that goes straight into the university's coffers, and I never see a dime of it. This is called overhead, or sometimes indirect cost. And the tax rate that I indicate above is about 42%. The rate of taxation is different at each university, and while it can range all the way up to 100% at some of the more prestigious schools, I've never seen it dip lower than 30%. This tax is ostensibly used to pay the university's air conditioning bill, fix the drinking fountains, and keep the toilets flushing, though I feel moved to mention that each of these things works only intermittently within the building that houses my laboratory. Anyway, the total cost of employing Bill for 3 years under this pitiful scenario is $150,000, which leaves a whopping $15,000 for all the chemicals and equipment necessary to do 3 years of state-of-the-art high-tech lab work, or to employ student help, or to do any travel, or to attend workshops and conferences. Oh, and remember, there's only $10,000 of spendable money because of the university's tax. Next time you meet a science professor, ask her if she ever worries that her findings might be wrong. If she worries that she chose an impossible problem to study, or that she overlooked some important evidence along the way. If she worries that one of the many roads not taken was perhaps the road to the right answer that she's still looking for. Ask a science professor what she worries about. It won't take long. She'll look you in the eye and say one word. Money. Chapter 6. A vine makes it up as it goes along. The copious vine seeds that rain down from the top of the forest sprout easily, but only rarely take root. Green and malleable, they search frantically for something to cling to, some scaffolding that will provide the strength that they so completely lack. Vines resolve to fight their way up to the light by any means necessary. They do not play by the rules of the forest. They place their roots in one optimal spot and grow their leaves elsewhere, a different optimum, usually several trees over. They are the only plant on land that grows farther sideways than it does up. Vines steal. They steal patches of light left unattended and rivulets of rain. Vines do not enter into apologetic symbiosis, but instead grow bigger at every opportunity, a dead scaffold being just as good as a living one. A vine's only weakness is its weakness. It desperately wants to grow as tall as a tree, but it doesn't have the stiffness necessary to do it politely. A vine finds its way to the sun using not wood, but pure grit and undiluted gall. An ivy plant sports thousands of rubbery green tendrils programmed to wrap around anything and everything, assuming that whatever each tendril touches is strong enough to support it, at least until something stronger comes along. It is a renegade that can improvise like no other. Should a tendril touch soil, it transforms itself into a root. Should a tendril touch rock, it grows suction cups and cements them firmly. A vine becomes whatever it needs to be and does whatever it must in order to make real its fabulous pretensions. Vines are not sinister, they are just hopelessly ambitious. They are the hardest working plants on earth. A vine can grow an entire foot in length on just one sunny day. Within their stems gush the highest rates of water transfer ever measured in a plant. Don't be fooled by the few red or brown leaves you find on poison ivy in the fall. The plant is not dying. It's just cheating with different pigments. Vines are evergreen, which means that they never take a day off. No long winter vacation, like the deciduous trees that they have laboriously scaled. On top of everything, Vines do not flower and bear seed until they reach the open sun above the canopy of the forest. And therefore, only the very strongest have ever survived. In an earthly age when people reign supreme, the strongest plants are becoming stronger. Vines cannot take over a healthy forest. They require a disturbance in order to take hold. Some gash has to create open soil, a hollow trunk, a sunny patch that a vine can come into. People can disturb like nothing else. We plow, pave, burn, chop, and dig. The edges and cracks of our cities support only one kind of plant, a weed. Something that grows fast and reproduces aggressively. A plant that lives where it should not is simply a pest, but a plant that thrives where it should not live is a weed. We don't resent the audacity of the weed, as every seed is audacious. We resent its fantastic success. Humans are actively creating a world where only weeds can live, and then feigning shock and outrage upon finding so many. This mixed message is irrelevant. There is already a revolution taking place in the plant world, as invasives effortlessly supplant natives within every human-modified space. Our impotent condemnation of weeds will not stop this revolution. We aren't getting the revolution we want. We're getting the one that we triggered. The vast majority of vines found in North America are invasive species whose seeds were accidentally imported from Europe and Eurasia along with tea, cloth, wool, and other basic necessities. Many who immigrated to America during the 19th century built a spectacular fortune in a new land. Freed from the torment of insects that had exploited their weaknesses generation after generation for millennia, these vines also flourished in the New World unfettered. The vine that we know by the name kudzu arrived in Philadelphia as a gift from Japan to honor the 1876 centennial. Since that time, kudzu has expanded to cover a total land area the size of Connecticut. Thick ribbons of kudzu embroider thousands of miles of highways in the American South. Kudzu thrives within the roadside ditches where we throw our beer cans and our cigarette butts. It is the living garbage of the plant world. Kudzu is perpetually where it should not be, blocking our view of prettier pink dogwoods. If we were to wade through the refuse and tease one out, we'd see that a single strand of kudzu can grow to be 100 feet long, easily twice the height of the forest. Kudzu is resigned to its lot as a parasite. It knows no other way. While the dogwood tree blooms, stationary and secure in its expectation of another glorious summer, the kudzu resolutely continues to grow 1 inch each hour, searching for its next temporary home. Chapter 7. After we followed Dumpling's directive to Monkey Jungle and received the epiphany that we were all just monkeys working in a monkey house, everything started to make sense. When I was separated from the lab, attending some seminar or conference, it was the series of twisted emails from Bill that held me fast to what I loved about my job, even while trapped with pasty middle-aged men who regarded me as they would a mangy stray that had slipped in through an open basement window. There's a place somewhere where I am part of the in-group, I would remind myself as I stood alone with my buffet dish in some Marriott ballroom, apparently radiating cooties and so excluded from the back-slapping stories of building mass spectrometers during the good old days. Each time I returned to Georgia Tech from traveling, I tried to throw myself into working even harder. I began to set aside one night a week as an all-nighter, Wednesdays. in order to complete the paperwork that went unattended while I served on committees tasked with documenting the potential obsolescence of chalkboards on campus. I learned that female professors and departmental secretaries are the natural enemies of the academic world,